Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 205. We're going to talk about whether you should have propane, butane, or electric for all the things that you want to make hot in your van, and that includes you. We're also going to talk about some news that doesn't seem to agree with itself. Some tech talk about the difference between converters and inverters, and a tale from the road involving an African van ride at night. Isn't it funny? You just add the word Africa to anything, and suddenly it's mysterious and interesting. I have a lot of thoughts on that. But anyway, welcome back. Thank you for tuning in once again to Built to Go. I am very, very pleased to be here with you, and let's dive right in here. So, things have changed over time. You know, it used to be that back in the day, the only way you could actually heat anything up in your van was propane. Every RV came with propane. Propane, propane, everything was propane. Your refrigerator's propane, everything. And, things have changed now, where batteries are a bit cheaper now, and we also have butane options. I thought I'd just do a rundown of the different pros and cons of all these different fuel sources. Now, this is going to be somewhat U.S.-centric because I understand that the availabilities of different gases are different in other countries. You can get butane in big bottles in other countries, while as in the U.S., it only comes in these little cans. We have propane tanks that you can swap out at any hardware store in the U.S. So it will be a bit U.S.-centric, but a lot of the stuff is universal, and it won't matter all that much. I'm also going to ignore, alternative sources of heat. I'm not going to talk about wood burners. I'm not going to talk about alcohol stoves or even diesel heaters. I'm not going to talk about, except in a glancing reference, because I'm talking about heating sources for cooking and general heating. Those are the things I want to focus on here. So, let's talk about the most common one. Even today, if you buy an RV or build out a van, you will at least consider propane. Nearly every RV comes with propane now and always has. Fewer of them now than used to. And I, in my ambulance, installed a propane locker so that I could have a big 20-pound bottle in there, which gives me tons of capacity for propane. Now, the reason I did this is because I think propane is a pretty good way, a pretty inexpensive and easy way to generate heat for a number of things. I use mine primarily for the cooktop. So I have a built-in cooktop, which I have thoughts about, but anyway. And I have that mounted on top of my propane locker. And inside that propane locker is the 20-pound can, and it has a regulator and a drain in the floor, a vent, which is required. If you store propane in your vehicle, you really want it to be in a locker, because if it leaks, not only is it explosive, it's poisonous, it's bad. So you want it to get out of the vehicle. And since it's heavier than air, the way you do that is to create an airtight locker with a vent in the floor that's at least 1 inch in diameter. If anything happens, the propane will leak underneath the van where things are a bit safer. That's what I have done. And I like it. I like that I have this massive capacity of propane, and I have a heater hooked up to it, an Olympian Wave 3 catalytic heater, and I have my double burner high capacity cook hooked up to it. And if I run out, I can just go anywhere and replace it. That's a lot of advantages for propane. But there are some disadvantages to propane. You're carrying around a gas that can leak out and be dangerous. That's absolutely true. Also, propane generates a lot of moisture. If you are cooking with propane in your vehicle, just having the burner on, part of that combustion process produces moisture. So you're going to instantly notice condensation on your windows, and we all know condensation's bad, so you always have to have a vent open. Also, it will use up oxygen, and while a lot of people are really afraid that they're going to asphyxiate because the flames have used up all the oxygen, that's really unlikely. Your van is not quite that airtight, and you will notice other things before that would happen. It's something to consider. I always recommend you have a vent open whenever you're using any kind of propane inside the van, but it's not like you're going to cook a can of soup and use up all the oxygen in the van and die. That isn't going to happen. But if you're looking for one solution for heat and cooking that's easy and readily accessible, I think propane is actually a decent solution. It does take up a lot of space. The cans can be heavy. And of course, those cans that you swap out aren't full. That's the gimmick there. They only fill them up 80%. So they're easier to deal with when really they just have you paying for more than you're getting. It is actually a lot cheaper to have that tank refilled, so do that. Now, those 1 pound cans that of propane, I don't like those at all. They create a waste problem, they're not easily recyclable, and those 1 pound cans just don't last that long. If you have, say, a buddy heater, you're not even going to get through the night on a single 1 pound can for heat. And oh, but you can refill them. Yeah, don't even get me started on that. For about $7 or $8 on eBay or on Amazon, you can buy these little things that will let you refill 1 pound cans. But 1 pound cans are not refillable in general. Unless you spend money on a refillable 1 pound can, and that costs about $20, those green ones you get at Walmart are not refillable. And the reason is that they're made really cheap. They're very thin steel. The valves are low quality. They're meant for single use. And if you refill them, you are risking having them leak and explode. And yes, they have killed people. This is a very controversial topic. People are like, I do it all the time. I've never had a problem. Right, that's true of every single person, even the ones who died, because up until that moment, they'd never had a problem either. Rant over. Okay, let's move on from propane now to butane. I am a big fan of butane for cooking. For $30 or even less, you can get a butane cooktop that works just as well as a cooktop in your house. These things are great. They're portable. You can cook several meals on one can of butane. They have a spark start, so you just turn the knob and boom, instant flame, very easily controllable. They're wonderful, and they're very popular in Asian cooking. In fact, if you're ever on the road and you need some butane and can't find any, and that's the big problem with butane in the US anyway, it's hard to find the right size cans. Asian markets will almost always have them because they use them all the time. They're great for putting a wok on top of. I get my butane bulk from Amazon. I get cases of 12, and that is by far the cheapest way to get your butane. So, another nice thing about butane in this configuration is that the cans are just cans. They're like cans of hairspray. So after I use mine up, I poke a hole in it using a can opener or a knife or whatever I have handy so that it's obvious that there's no gas in it. And yes, I make sure there's no gas in it before I do this. And then I just recycle it with all my steel stuff. It's just steel that can be recycled. And that's a really nice thing and a big advantage over the propane canisters because a lot of steel recycling places won't take them, largely because they can't tell if they're empty or not. Now, butane does produce moisture, just like the propane does, so cooking inside with it, yeah, you've got the moisture problems, you still need to vent, but the little butane stoves are so portable that I will often just take mine and go out and cook on a picnic table or whatever, and it's dead simple. I don't have to hook up any hoses or anything. Now, to hedge my bets, and all right, I guess I'll have a link in the show notes to the one I've got. I've got this gas one butane cooker that also comes with a propane adapter. So if I'm ever out on the road and I can't find butane, I can hook up one of those 1 pound cans. And for this use, the 1 pound cans aren't terrible. I can cook a few meals with the 1 pound can, but then I still have the problem of what the heck do I do with that 1 pound can when I'm done? See, I'm ranting about that again. You can tell I really don't like these green 1 pound cans of propane. Butane for general heating, not really so good. They do sell some heaters that run on these things, and a lot of them are actually cooktops that flip over and become a heater. They're a little janky and kind of scary, and I'm not thinking that's a great way to do any kind of heating except for like a little warm-up in the morning or something like that. You wouldn't want to heat your van overnight with butane, I don't think. But hey, for $30 or even less, you can have a really nice cooking solution. In fact, when I build out my truck, I think that's what I'm going to use for cooking. I'm not going to install anything permanent. I may not even have propane at all. I might just have a butane cooktop and a diesel heater. Now let's talk about electric. The new hotness. Well, electric has a lot going for it. I mean, a lot of the big-name YouTubers who are out there in the wilderness boondocking it, they use electric to cook, and they may be using an induction cooktop where you can use any iron-based pan to cook on, or maybe they're using an Instant Pot or a crock pot or anything like that. And yeah, it's absolutely great. I mean, electric heat is exactly what you want. It uses exactly as much energy as you need to cook the food. It's a little difficult to adjust the temperature sometimes, but it produces no moisture other than what you get from cooking. I mean, if you're going to boil spaghetti, it doesn't matter what you're cooking it on. It's producing moisture. But a really nice thing about electric is it gives you a bunch of options. I mean, you can use an induction cooktop. You can use an electric kettle. You can use an instant pot. You can have all these different options. And yeah, okay, each one of these devices takes up space, but still, you have those options. You never have to worry about flame. There's nothing to explode. The big downside to electric cooking is that you need to spend a lot of money up front. You need a very robust battery. You need a big inverter. You need very thick wires, good fuses. And with all of these, of course, you're going to have a smoke detector and a CO detector. Yes, you're going to have a CO detector even if you're cooking with electric, because there's many other sources of CO in a vehicle, not just cooking. So you are going to want one of those. Now, electric for general heating, like to heat up the inside of your van, that's a lot more tricky. That requires so much electricity. It's like air conditioning. If you can air condition your van off your batteries, you could probably heat it off your batteries too. But with both of those, you've got the same problem of you have enough power to run your AC, but do you have a way to recharge it? That is the difficult part. Now, my Airstream has an air conditioner. And that air conditioner is a heat pump, so I can actually reverse it and have it produce heat, which actually works. If it's about 45 degrees out, I will put on the heat pump rather than the propane furnace, and that'll heat up the rig just fine. But there's a couple of problems with it. It does use a lot of electricity, and the heat comes out of vents in the ceiling, which means that I get this nice hot layer at the ceiling, and it's still cold on the floor. So if you are looking at those rooftop heat pump air conditioners, know that, yeah, they'll make heat if it's above 40 degrees Fahrenheit or, say, 5 degrees Celsius, but it's not a great heat. Also, electric is less portable. I mean, you can have a big old Jackery and bring it out to the picnic table and your induction cooktop, but you're basically stuck with the van, whereas with the butane option, you can carry that stove anywhere and it's much easier. Just a little thing. So, which is the best? Which of these should you do? As with all things in van life, it is what you want, and I'm not recommending any of these over the others. I think they all have advantages, and that's why I have all three in my van. I can cook with electric, butane, and propane, and I can heat my van with propane and, well, electric. I have an electric blanket in my van, and I'm going to call that electric. So anyway, those are some of your options. When you're building out your van, be sure to consider each one. Decide what's best for you. And, some of these you can just change your mind on, too. You know, if there's one piece of advice from all this, get one of those little butane cookers. They're just so versatile and so effective, and they take up not very much space. I think that's kind of a must-have for just about everybody. Thank you to everybody who has donated gallons of diesel to this show. You may do so at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. The folks who have donated and become members make it so that this show has no ads, either on YouTube or on whatever the heck you're listening to it on right now. So thank you, guys, and thank you for not having ads in the podcast, because I don't like ads in podcasts, and you guys make that possible. Let's move on to some van life news. Several people sent me this article. It's funny, this article has been reproduced in a bunch of different papers, but I think it started in the Wall Street Journal. And the title is, "No Showers, No Sleep. Van Life Isn't As Cool as Instagram Makes It Seem." Wow! Shocker! What amazing news! Stop the presses! I'm is the Wall Street Journal, 5 years behind the times? I mean, we've been talking about this since the very start of this podcast. This is nothing new, but it's amazing to me that it's still popular to publish articles bashing van life, usually from people who just got started and haven't figured it out yet. Now, in the case of this story, and I'll have a link in the show notes, this poor person was having a hard time finding housing, thought it would be cheaper to do van life, myth number one, and bought a van and moved into it, and then the transmission went in her van and ate up all her savings. It was a $5,000 repair, and then she was stuck and miserable, and yeah, That's true. The same thing would be true if she bought a house and didn't have savings to cover it, or if she bought an apartment and had some kind of major medical problem in the U.S., etc. This is not an indictment of van life, and these articles, I think, are similar to the articles bashing cruises, is that they're mostly for people who have never done it and have no interest in doing it. So you, fellow van life enthusiast, will not find anything enlightening in these articles. I mean, go ahead and read them, because, you know, it's interesting to see these perspectives and good to be aware of public perception. But, yeah, there was nothing to learn here. It was just another piece about, oh, those van life people, haha, they're not having as much fun as it seems. And yet, here we are. Now, another piece of news that I saw right after this. This was interesting. I searched a little different. I always, when I'm looking for news, I always search van life as one word. This time I searched for van life as two words, van space life. You get totally different results, which is annoying to me, but that is how it is. And one of the things it brought up was this article from Reader's Digest, of all places, and it was UK Reader's Digest. I didn't even realize there was a different Reader's Digest for the UK, but there is. And I found this really nice article called How Embracing the Van Life Helped Me Beat the Cost of Living. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of the other article, and it's a story about this woman who had all kinds of financial hardships after COVID, which is completely understandable, and moved into a van to save money, and she was just going to do it for a little while, but it worked out so well, and she loved it so much that she's been doing it for a while now. Very well-written article, lots of insight there, and something I highly recommend all van life folks read. And so again, that's in the Reader's Digest. I'll have a link in the show notes, but that's the title of it. How Embracing the Van Life Helped Me Beat the Cost of Living. The URL is gigantic, which seems to be the trend these days. And then I found another one, this time from Business Insider. Now, if you'll remember, way back 100 episodes or so ago, I don't even remember, a long time ago, I interviewed an author who wrote a piece for Business Insider about how they had rented a van, a camper van, and went out and hated it. And they didn't know how to use it. They couldn't turn the battery on. They didn't understand why the plugs wouldn't work. I mean, it was kind of comedic in how poorly set up they were. And I blame the people they got the van from. I mean, if I ever said, hey, you want to borrow my ambulance for the night and threw them the keys, I don't know what the heck they would do, because we're going to have to spend a couple hours talking about just how to use the thing. And apparently these people didn't get that. But now Business Insider has a new article called, I spent years considering van life and finally embarked on a 2-week trip last fall. 5 months later, I'm still dreaming of the lifestyle. And it's a positive story about someone who dipped their toe into van life and loved it and is now changing their life to be more van life. Another article worth reading, and again, it's from Business Insider, who has posted many, many articles about how van life isn't as beautiful as it seems. So, you know, these people, these publications are, they're all ultimately clickbait at some degree. They're just trying to get you to click. But it was interesting to me that while we're still seeing all these anti-van life clickbait things on YouTube and everything, there are some pro-van life things too, and maybe that trend will grow. At the end of the day, I don't care. I only want the truth. And the truth is that both of these things are true. Van life is, as one of the articles say, 10 times more difficult than anything else. It's also wonderful and freeing. It's both of those things. And once you understand that, you are ready for van life. Tech Talk. I have been talking with a friend of mine, and he's doing some changes to his trailer. And he's going from regular batteries to lithium. Hello, Hal. And one of the things that came up, which I think is a little confusing for folks, is the difference between a converter and an inverter. And we hear these terms, but in van life, we mostly deal with inverters. Now, an inverter is something that takes DC, direct current, and changes it to AC, alternate current. It is inverting the current. That is what an inverter does. Although we don't think of the DC AC so much as the voltage change. and an inverter will take 12 volts DC and turn it into 120 volts AC, or 240 volts AC if you're in a country with a more modern electrical system than we have in the US. That's what an inverter does. So if you were going to use a microwave oven in your van, you would have an inverter for that. It would take power from the batteries, change it into household power, and power your microwave. That's an inverter. Oddly, in the RV world, inverters are fairly rare. They're a luxury item. Not all that many rigs have them, but many, 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 many rigs have converters. Even my 1993 Scamp, which is pretty bare bones, has, or had, because it's broken, a converter. A converter is nearly the opposite of an inverter, but not completely. It takes shore power, 120 volts or 240 volts, depending where you are, and changes it to 12 volts DC. So it is converting AC to DC, which somehow is not called inverting in this case. I don't know why they chose that word. But it is converting AC to DC down to the voltage that your batteries produce. And this is a major difference, RV converters also charge your batteries. They do both. They provide 12 volts and charge your batteries as separate functions. So if you have a converter and your battery's dead, if you plug in your rig, your converter will instantly turn all the lights on like your battery's not dead anymore and will charge your battery. That's what makes a converter different from a battery charger. Because if you think about it, if you get an off-the-shelf battery charger, well, what are you doing? You're plugging it into the wall of your house, 120 volts, and out of it comes 12 volts to charge your battery. So isn't that the same thing as a converter? The terminology here is crap. I don't like it, and that's why I wanted to talk about this. So, starting in reverse, a battery charger only changes household current to 12 volts and charges your battery, and that's it. A converter does that same thing. It will charge your battery, but also provides its own 12-volt source to your entire rig. So even if you don't have a battery, theoretically, a converter should be able to turn on all the 12-volt stuff in your rig. And an inverter is the opposite of all this. It uses your battery power to power household outlets. I think I still made this more confusing than it should be. And I don't know why they call these things these names. But they do. There's some history here, and it's important for you to know the difference. For what it's worth, very few van builds I've ever seen have converters in them, because you can use a battery charger almost the same way. If you hook up a battery charger to your battery in your van and have that hooked up to shore power, and then you use your battery-powered devices, your 12-volt devices, it's a different way of having shore power power your stuff. Rather than doing it directly, it's doing it through the battery. Little bit subtle, but anyway, just know that a converter goes from 110 volts to 12 volts, and an inverter goes from 12 volts to 110 volts or 120 volts, and you'll be in good shape for figuring out what you need. And then maybe I'll have to do another tech talk on the difference between 110 volts and 120 volts, or why our 12-volt batteries are like 13.3 volts. Anyway, it's called nominal voltage. It's not real. It's just what we talk about. Anyway, this stuff gets complicated pretty quick, doesn't it? Forget most of what I said. Just know what an inverter and a converter does, and you'll be nearly all the way there. Product review. On a whim, as an experiment, I bought these lights. It's called Nilight, N-I-L-I-G-H-T, 60 LED light. And this is a string of lights, not like Christmas lights, but like bricks. There are like these little bricks, like maybe the size of a small Snickers bar. Not the fun size, the next bigger size, and maybe a quarter as thick. They're these little like pucks. And they're attached to each other by two wires. So you've got a puck and then 3 inches of wire, another puck, 3 inches of wire, another puck, 3 inches of wire. And it's this whole big long strand of these things. And they have this really, really sticky double-sided tape on them. And the idea is that you just stick them wherever you want, give them 12 volts, and boom, you've got nice light. And what is interesting about these is that you cut them wherever you want. It's almost like a roll of tape if that tape was lights. Oh, I only need 3 lights today. Reel off 3 lights, snip, and then you put up your 3 lights. Oh, I need 4 this time. Reel off your 4. That's what it's like. It comes with, I don't remember how many lights it comes with, but it's like 20. It's a lot of them. And I just went wild in my van putting them up. I put some up on the ceiling, hidden behind a piece of trim, and I put some on underneath the shelves. And I have to say, for $16, this is a bargain. You can basically get enough lights for your whole van for $16. Now, all you're getting is the lights and these little pigtail wires. You have to do your own wiring, and you have to have your own switches and fuses. You have to do all that stuff yourself. But if you're building out a van and you want, like, say, lights in your cabinets, you want one light in each of your cabinets or your drawers or even under the van, what an inexpensive, simple way to do it. The quality of the light is excellent. I don't know if it's dimmable because I didn't bother to go through hooking up a dimmer. I would guess not. At this price point, I would guess not. And my only complaint about these things is that the wire is very thin. And while that's fine, these things draw such little power, there's no danger of the wire catching fire, the thin wire makes it hard to connect it to things. Like Wago connectors, those clippy connectors, they wouldn't really hold it because the wire was so thin. So what I did was I stripped back twice as much insulation, folded the wire on itself, twisted it, and then used the Wago connector, and that kind of worked. But I don't like those kind of connections because it's very easy to rip them out. In a couple cases, I used butt connectors with crimps, and I crimped them down really hard, and that seemed to work. But I think that's the Achilles heel of these lights, is that the wires are very thin. But that said, I have really nice lighting in my van now, and it only cost me $16. I actually just used some of the existing switches in the ambulance, and I had wire. I just used zip cord wire. Speaker wire, basically. I got a big roll of speaker wire for some very low amperage things, and that's what I used for this, and it works just fine. So I'll have a link in the show notes. You definitely need to see a picture of this to fully understand what it is, but it's the Nylight 60 LED light. It's on Amazon, and it's about $16. I think it's a bargain. Tales from the road. So I was just in Africa, and there's a lot of things in Africa that are different than in the US, and some of those things are better. And some of those things are not as good. One of the things that's better in Africa is that they have a greater variety of vans that they can get. We had Toyota Quantum vans, which were very nice. This is kind of an updated version of the Toyota Hiace, and it's a front engine van, so you don't have that hump. So it's much more comfortable inside. It would be a great van to build out, but apparently they're mostly sold in South Africa. So I don't expect you to see them running down the road on I-80 anytime soon. Chicken tax. Yeah, we're not going to rant about that today. But as it would happen, the van that we spent the most of our time in was a Sprinter. It was a fairly new Sprinter. I would guess it was a 2021 or so. Not the fanciest of the Sprinters, but it was a 2500 170, I think. I don't know exactly how extended it was, but it was pretty big. This was a big van. And, you know, I'm like, oh boy, a Sprinter. I get to ride in a Sprinter. I drive a Sprinter. You know, this is kind of fun. And I get in there, and I instantly notice something very different about this Sprinter from the Sprinters in the U.S., and that is that they sit 4 across in Africa. So in most vans, the seating is 3 across, but since African folks tend to be a bit smaller than American folks, they fit them 4 across. Now, the group I was with was Americans of normal American size, and we had to sit in this van for hours in these very cramped conditions, and I have to say it was very uncomfortable. Also, it was a manual transmission, which you can't get in the U.S., and I know a lot of the Europeans are like, what? What do you mean? Yeah, no, all vans in the U.S. are automatic. That's just how it is over here. Very few people know how to drive a stick, which is good and bad, depending. Anyway, the van was crazy uncomfortable, but we took the van from the lodge we were staying at to a different lodge because they had different animals, and half of our ride was on washboard dirt roads. And so we're cramped in this van, shoulder to shoulder. There was something wrong with the door, and it squeaked just like this really, it wasn't like your normal ee, it wasn't a little squeak, it was this intense kind of urgent, like, I'm squeaking so hard I'm going to fall off kind of a squeak every single bump. For hours. It was not my favorite part of the trip. Nobody was having a good time. And then at some point during the trip, some of the other people we were with started this intense political conversation that I just did not want to have any part of. And I had forgotten my headphones. And anyway, this wasn't my favorite time. So I stared out the window. I was fortunate enough to have had a window seat and just saw stuff. And one of the things I noticed was that this was an African highway. So comparable to what we have as interstates in the U.S., although this would not be mistaken for an interstate. There's no line markings at all on the road. It's just a strip of pavement, two lane, and there are bushes on the side of the road, and they encroach upon the road. Like, if you go over to the edge of the pavement, the bushes and tall grasses will brush against the side of your vehicle at highway speeds. If there are any critters hiding in those bushes, and I have come to believe that there are critters in Africa, you're going to have zero chance of avoiding them because these bushes and grass are 4 feet tall. So that was kind of an interesting thing. And doing that at night was, I don't know if nerve-wracking is the right word, but yeah, I'm going to stick with interesting. Now, the vans down there, as in some places in Europe, have a little number on the back in a circle, and that's their speed limit. Different classes of vehicles have different speed limits, and they're pasted on the back of the vehicles. So I think ours was a 120 kilometer per hour van, and that's about 75 miles per hour in U.S. measurement, which, you know, that's plenty fast, so that wasn't a problem. But our driver was really timid. So we were all in the van, desperate to get out of the thing, and our driver's being just very timid, and I could see the speedometer, and it never got near 120. It barely got over 100, even when we were on straight parts of the road and there was no one there. And he didn't speak a lot of English, and I was like, oh, I can't blame this guy for being safe. He's, you know, he has a lot of responsibility here. I can't bug him, but man, I really wished he'd go faster. And then we got to this really amazingly windy mountain road, and we noticed at one point that there was a hole in this very flimsy-looking guardrail that kind of went over a cliff. I'm like, I wonder what happened there. I hope it was just a rock or something. Didn't really think any more of it than that, but it felt fairly safe, and it was beautiful, so I was looking at all the scenery. This is a very rural part of, it's the Watersburg area of South Africa, if you want to look it up, called Watersburg Biosphere. It's kind of a nature area, which is beautiful. But anyway, you know, we finished our ride and got back, and I thought, okay, good, I'm never doing that again. I'm done with that van, except I wasn't because I had to go to the airport. But anyway, get home, don't really think about the van ride so much, because, you know, that's kind of how it is when you go on vacation. The uncomfortable bits of the plane ride and the van ride, you know, they kind of fade behind all the cool stuff you see, and that's a good thing. And I'm not going to try to encourage remembering the uncomfortable parts, but I was forced to, because I saw an article in the news about a bus crash in South Africa that killed 45 people. In fact, there was only one 8-year-old girl who survived this bus crash. It was a bunch of folks from Botswana who were going to some sort of Easter gathering for their church, African Zionist Church. I can't remember what it was called. It was something like that. But, yeah, horrific. They were in some kind of a bus. I can't tell what kind of a bus it was because the wreckage is so bad. And it went over a cliff and caught fire and killed everybody except for this one 8-year-old. And I thought, huh, I wonder where that happened. I mean, that sounds very much like that incident with the guardrail we saw where there was a hole in the guardrail. And I looked it up on the map, and it was on that very road, not too far from that guardrail we had seen. And yeah, we made it. They didn't. Our bus driver was driving slowly and carefully, our van driver. I don't know what happened in this case. They may have had a mechanical problem, an animal might have run out. I don't know what happened. I'm not blaming anybody. But it is a little sobering to realize that I was just in the same situation as these people, and I lived to complain about how uncomfortable the ride was, and they didn't. I'll have a link in the show notes if you want to read about the disaster. A place to visit. Keeping it closer to home, I thought, you know, let's pick something from Chicago today. And one thing that you should visit is the Buckingham Fountain. Buckingham Fountain is this massive fountain. It's one of the largest fountains in the world. And it was designed after the fountain in Versailles. And it's interesting, this, who's Buckingham? What does this have to do with Chicago? Well, it was just some philanthropist woman whose brother died, and she built this in dedication to him. Not a huge Chicago-based story. It was just, you know, a sister's grief at losing her brother, and she had a lot of money. So she not only built this massive fountain, she donated enough money to the city for its upkeep, which is very, very smart. This fountain is supposed to represent Lake Michigan, but it being built in the 20s, it's very Rococo. It's got all kinds of ornamentation on it. And there's mare horses, seahorses, but they're not really seahorses. They're like land horses with big spirally tails in it. They shoot water up, and it's this kind of fountain where the water trickles down, and then things shoot the water back up, and that's how the water gets to the top. It's interesting, and it's very iconic. If you've ever seen Married with Children, the TV show, the fountain at the beginning is the Buckingham Fountain. In fact, when I first moved to Chicago, I was like, oh, look, it's the Married with Children fountain. And everybody with me who was from Chicago was like, God, is that what people know this for? It's one of the iconic symbols of Chicago, but it's been kind of downplayed because of the Bean, which is right down the road from it. So this is at one end of Route 66. It's not exactly at the end of Route 66. It's a few blocks away, but a lot of people think of it as the end of Route 66 because where Route 66 ends in Chicago is kind of amorphous. They've moved it a few times, and now it's on one-way streets, so where it begins is actually a different street from where it ends. It's all kind of confusing. So this whole area where the Art Institute is and this fountain is considered to be the beginning or the end of Route 66. Now, the fountain has a few little secrets. Should you walk around the fountain, and it's remember, it's quite big, you'll find this little subterranean house kind of a thing. And it has some windows, and you can look in them. And it's the pump house. And it's incredibly intricate. And you might think, well, why is this more than just an on-off switch? Well, it turns out that this fountain does a show every night. It does this patriotic display with lights and music, and it's really, really hokey. But it's so hokey that it's kind of a piece of historic Americana. You know, think back to the very white bread Disney-esque Main Street USA kind of America that never really existed, but people have memories of that kind of America. That's what this display is like. And you can actually see all the different controls for it in this booth. It's all done by computers now. And in fact, at one time, the entire thing was controlled by a desk in Kentucky for some reason. I don't actually know why they would do that. But anyway, if you're visiting Chicago on a summer evening, go ahead and walk down to the fountain and have a look at this show. It's just an interesting, fun place to be at night in Chicago. And while they have them during the day, they're every hour on the hour starting at 9 a.m., they really are impressive at night. And they go until 10:35 at night. That's when the last one ends. So that's the time to see it. Go visit the Bean. Go visit the big towers that shoot water at you. And then go check out Buckingham Fountain. It's just kind of a pretty place on the lake. Resource recommendation. Really simple resource that you may know of, but you may not really realize how useful it is. If you go to Google, you just type the words, whatever city you want, so I'll do Chicago, and then the word weather. That's it. And you will get a display of the weather for that city. And it's like this little widget thing that comes up in the webpage. But that little widget thing is actually very useful. It takes its information from weather.com. And if you've ever used weather.com, that website is a mess. It's full of ads. It's difficult to figure out where you're going. And it takes a few clicks to actually get the weather information you want. But this Google Weather widget actually will just show you in several different forms of information what's going on for the upcoming week. So the first thing it does is temperature, and it will tell you the high and low for each day. Like for this week, starting today, it's going to be 37 for the high and 34 for the low, and the little picture shows snow and rain. So I know all that instantly. And then Thursday, more of the same, 41-35. Friday, the sun's going to come out a little bit, etc., all through the week. That's useful enough, but there's a lot more going on here. Above that is a chart of the temperature for the day, and it's a line, and it goes up and down as the temperature will go up for the day. Now, today, since it's already 37 as I'm recording this, it's going to basically stay the same. The line doesn't move much, but if it were a day where there's a huge temperature shift, you could see that, oh, at 6 o'clock tonight, the temperature's going to go way down or whatever. Another really useful quick-at-a-glance thing if you're trying to plan your trip. If you go up from there, you'll notice that the word temperature is underlined. To the right of that is the word precipitation, and you can click on that. When you do, it changes that line graph to be the precipitation graph. And that is super useful. It'll tell you what time it's going to rain and how much. Like today, I can see that it's going to rain the most at about noon. And the time it's going to rain the least looks like it's going to be around midnight. And that's very useful if you're planning some van life. You know, what time should we leave? What time should we pack up? A quick glimpse at this will help. And the last thing, which is also super useful, is wind. Right next to precipitation, there's a wind button or word. Click on that, and it'll show you the wind, and it shows you in numbers how fast it'll be, 15, 18, 18, 17 miles per hour, that's how it is now. And then it will show you arrows from which direction the wind is blowing, like right now the wind is 15 miles per hour coming from the west. And the size of the arrow tells you how gusty it is. So, okay, it's a 15-mile-per-hour steady wind. Well, that's different than 30-mile-per-hour gusts and still air. You'll still get 15 miles per hour as an average, but it's good to know how gusty it is. And the size of the arrow tells you how gusty it is. So right now, it's not very gusty, but at 2 p.m., the average wind speed is going to be 18 miles per hour, and the arrow is much bigger, so I know it's going to be gusty. And that, I can tell you, if you have an awning or a tent or anything outdoors, it's the gusts you care about. I know that with my awnings that I have set up down in Tiki Bago Land, if it's going to be gusting over 25 miles per hour, I bring them all in. And I know some people are much more conservative than that. So this is a very simple little thing if you're just trying to figure out the weather and you don't want to go through dealing with an app or trying to fight your way through weather.com or Wonderground or whatever. Just go to Google, type in name of city, weather, and you'll get this very simple, nicely managed display. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 205. Music, as always, is by Simon Wag. If you'd like to get a hold of me, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And for those of you heading out for the eclipse, I wish you fair weather. Although, boy, it's not looking too good, is it? We'll see how it goes. Until next time, remember the words of John Ruskin, who said, "Sunshine is delicious. Rain is refreshing. Wind braces us up. Snow is exhilarating. There is really no such thing as bad weather. Only different kinds of good weather."